Susan Roy, performing Musqueam culture and history at British Columbia's 1966 centennial celebrations. BC Studies, Perspectives on Aboriginal Culture, number 135, autumn 2002. They're mixing some heap big medicine out at the Musqueam Indian Reserve, and they don't want the white man mixing into the tom-tom beats, the chanting and other dances of a secret ancient Indian ritual society. I went down to the smokehouse on the banks of the Fraser. It is a cedar siding building put up by the Indians themselves. It has the appearance of a community center, but without windows. As I approached the gloomy building, I began to hear the beat and chant. The rhythm was deep and quick. The voices were an animal sound in time with the drums, eerie. It kept going, reverberating through the wooden walls. The Beatles flashed through my mind. It was definitely psychedelic, but with a wilder, more sinister throb. On the riverside, I found a door. I knocked. The beat stopped. I opened the door. For a flashing instant, I saw the dancers in the gloom inside. They stood transfixed. I couldn't see their features, although every head was turned to the sudden light of the open doorway. The door slammed. The dance scene was erased. So reported Ed Simons of the province when he was denied access to the Musqueam Smokehouse during the initiation of new spirit dancers in the winter of 1968. Simons was investigating reports that a Musqueam man, who had filed a complaint with the Department of Indian Affairs, was to be initiated into the ritual society against his wishes. He is afraid the society is going to shanghai him and beat him into becoming an Indian dancer. In characterizing this ceremonial practice as a dark and featureless remnant of pre-contact Aboriginal society, Simons described the scene with unusual discriminatory undertones that mark newspaper accounts of Indian reserve life. In fact, the Winter Spirit Dance had long been and remains an important religious institution of Coast Salish life. During their initiation period, individuals went through a series of ritual procedures to acquire power from a non-human spiritual source. Initiates then performed this power during winter ceremonies conducted in smokehouses through Coast Salish country. The spirit dance's tremendous religious and cultural significance is described in the Musqueam's 1984 comprehensive land claim submission to the federal government. Quote, "This was the most personal and private experience a person could have. It was not revealed to others, nor talked about. Continued dreams and communication strengthened the gift, and with assistance from other persons in power, an individual learned to control and eventually was able to express the power in a performance of a personal song and dance. If managed in the proper way, this association gave strength and capabilities beyond those of simple human experience. If mismanaged, it could bring illness and death." End quote. Rarely did these personal religious experiences reach the non-Aboriginal world as a news story. Indeed, the non-Aboriginal public was quite unaware that this type of ceremonial activity occurred within the context of reserve communities. Above all, Simons' 1968 account underscores the inaccessibility of this aspect of Musqueam culture to Vancouver's non-Coast Salish residents. The dance scene was erased, as the news reporter put it. In 1966, 2 years prior to the province's account of Musqueam cultural practice, the Musqueam were invited to perform a traditional dance as part of the province's centennial commemoration of the uniting of the colonies of Vancouver Island and British Columbia. This project, known as the Root of the Totems, involved the installation of a series of totem poles along the recently constructed Vancouver Island Highway and the major ferry terminals. Delta's mayor, Clarence Taylor, asked local Indian bands to participate in the dedication ceremony for the pole raised at the entrance of the Tsawwassen ferry terminal. On the afternoon of July 30, 1966, a crowd of centennial celebrants gathered to watch the unveiling and the accompanying Aboriginal entertainment. Squamish Chief Simon Baker, dressed in, quote, "colorful, authentic Indian costume representing several bands," end quote, opened the show with a love song. His medicine man, Elder Dominic Charlie, who, it was reported, was almost 90 years old, performed a deer dance. The Squamish were joined by a delegation of Musqueam men, including Elder James Point, Chief Dominic Point, band manager Willard Sparrow, Vincent Stogan, and Walker Stogan, who performed a warrior song and dance. In their vigorous physical routine, the dancers with painted faces and armed with long wooden spears mimicked warriors in pursuit of their enemies. Sparrow, James Point, and Dominic Point accompanied this dance with a song about the famous warrior Kewapulenokwe. The spectators were told that the song and dance reenacted an ancient ritual before going to war, and that the choreographed warfare depicted Musqueam's success in repelling northern warriors during their raids on villages on the lower Fraser. In their performance, the Musqueam emerged as victorious. As Dominic Point told the audience, the dance means we are strong men. Later that evening, in the parking lot of the Suwasan Shopping Center, the Aboriginal participants hosted a salmon barbecue, during which they made Mayor Taylor an honorary chief of the Suwasan and gave him the ancestral name Kimmit. The naming ceremony included the public performance of Musqueam mask dancers. These two scenarios, the initiation of the spirit dancer at the Musqueam Smokehouse in 1968 as reported by the province, and the public presentation of the warrior dance and the mask dance at the Suwasan Centennial event in 1966, also reported in the press and remembered by community members today, highlight two very different settings for Musqueam dance performances. The spirit dance takes place within the Coast Salish community, within a ceremonial context and in the presence of Musqueam and other Coast Salish people, along with their invited guests. It is a part of the presentation of personal identity, private knowledge, and spirituality within that Aboriginal community. In a similar vein, the mask dance is a hereditary privilege usually performed during community ceremonies, and although it has moved in and out of public view during the 20th century, it is rarely performed within non-Aboriginal contexts. In contrast to these internal performances, Musqueam people occasionally produce dance routines in response to non-Aboriginal appeals. In the late 1930s, Vancouver Folk Festival organizer Nellie McKay booked the Musqueam dance troupe for her shows, stressing that the designs of our own coast Indians differ greatly from those of the layered Indians, and erroneously claiming that every stitch or pattern has a story to tell if we have the eyes and the knowledge to read it. Musqueam individuals also organized a warrior performance for the 1939 Royal Tour of King George VI and Queen Elizabeth. For the 1958 centennial, marking the 100th anniversary of the formation of the colony of British Columbia, Centennial Events producer Gordon Hilkner attempted to recruit the Charles family, whom he identified as having considerable stature amongst the anti-feather war bonnet group, to form the Kewapulenokwe song in his recreation of Simon Fraser's 1808 journey down the Fraser River. At the Musqueam village, as the popular story goes, Fraser encountered hostile Indians who prevented him from reaching the sea. Hilkner wrote that Christine Charles knows the song which the great warrior Capilano sang to raise his armies to battle pitch. This was done, apparently, from a stage consisting of four canoes lashed together and covered with split cedar planking which traveled back and forth in front of the shore campfires. Hilkner was pleased that Charles offered to weave bulrush mats for the canoe pullers so that they would be housed in authentic fashion. While the historical context surrounding these shows varied, it was for each of these public settings that the Musqueam mobilized the tradition of the warrior to construct a dance specifically for non-Aboriginal consumption. To be sure, the image of the Aboriginal warrior could meet the expectations of non-Aboriginal audiences, who demanded that Indigenous cultural traditions be limited to flamboyant costumes, drumming, singing, and dancing. Whites preferred their Indians in feathers and war paint, writes historian Daniel Francis. Yet at the same time, this warrior dance, with its distinctive Salish costumes and links to regional tradition and history, offered a local variation on the warrior theme, countering the popularized stereotypical feather war bonnet Indian that in 1958 Centennial Events producer Gordon Hilkner had tried so hard to avoid. According to Musqueam people today, the warrior dance was rarely, if ever, performed in the longhouse setting within the Musqueam community. Anthropologists Fred Myers and Julie Cruikshank have argued that to better understand cultural performances directed to multi-ethnic audiences, we should treat them not as isolated cultural texts, but rather as tangible forms of social action embedded in the larger field of political, economic, and cultural production. While much scholarship emphasizes how intercultural events serve the interests of dominant society, commentators should not lose sight of the fact that Aboriginal peoples autonomously confer meaning on the circumstances that confront them. Similarly, in relation to a 1941 competition between the University of Washington's rowing team and the Swinomish Indians' racing canoes, anthropologist Bruce Miller shows that cultural, in this case athletic, display was part of a media performance to publicize the Swinomish economic vitality and political independence. For the Swinomish, intercultural performance contributed to the development and maintenance of positive economic relations with non-Aboriginal neighbors. It strengthened tribal autonomy and identity and advanced political recognition in the non-Aboriginal world. Miller reveals that coordinating and participating in local public events was a diplomatic strategy often employed by Coast Salish leaders during the mid-20th century. These seemingly small public dramas are part of a larger representational strategy towards and dialogue with non-Aboriginal society. Similarly, on British Columbia's centennial stage, participation in state-organized celebrations offered Aboriginal people the opportunity to appropriate and to reshape representations of dominant history for their own purposes, enabling them to upgrade their Aboriginal identity in the public's eye. For Aboriginal peoples, a part of the motivation to participate in commemorative events related to the political necessity to present themselves as authentic and historic. Spectators could come to understand the Musqueam through their cultural presentations. And, as Julie Cruikshank tells us, the stakes for effective translation become higher in a world where culture is a marker of authenticity in political negotiations, and where conflicting folk models of culture operate simultaneously. To be sure, in the eyes of the dominant society, distinctiveness and authenticity have become prerequisites of BC First Nations political and even legal legitimacy. It seems to be increasingly the case that, in order to be acknowledged, descriptions of traditional territories need to be fixed according to Western legal notions of occupation and exclusivity. During the provincial centennial, Aboriginal peoples presented themselves in ways that ensured public acknowledgement and that responded to demands that Aboriginal culture be both visibly local and rooted in a pre-contact past. Centennial presenters were certainly interested in involvement from local Aboriginal groups, displaying local cultural traditions. However, as we will see, Aboriginal peoples and provincial organizers held different views with regards to what constituted British Columbia's identity and history, as well as with regard to what constituted cultural authenticity and distinctiveness. To look more carefully at the role of performance in constructing a public identity for First Nations in British Columbia in general, and for the Musqueam in particular, I'll discuss the general context of the centennial celebrations organized between 1958 and 1971, and then go on to explore how both the state and Aboriginal peoples negotiated their respective histories at these events. I will then focus on the province's Root of the Totem project, and the Musqueam's response to the installation of a totem pole at Tsawwassen and to the story it told. Finally, I will further explore the relationship between culture, politics, and identity by examining how the Musqueam drew upon different kinds of performative traditions in order to produce their show. Historian James Clifford reminds us that throughout the world, Indigenous populations have had to reckon with the forces of progress and national unification. Many traditions, languages, cosmologies, and values are lost, some literally murdered. But much has simultaneously been invented and revived in complex oppositional contexts. This case study attempts to show that the production and performance of a public identity was shaped both by internal cultural protocol and by an interest in creating a public image amenable to pursuing a resolution to Aboriginal land claims. Since contact with European societies, the Musqueam and other First Nations in British Columbia have been reminding non-Aboriginals that they have lived here from time immemorial. Musqueam's theatrical performance of British Columbia's centennial celebrations in 1966 was, in its simplest form, one of those reminders. In the late 1950s, the province began to plan for its upcoming centennials, commemorating the establishment of the colony of British Columbia in 1858, the union of the colonies of British Columbia and Vancouver Island in 1866, the Canadian Confederation in 1867, and the entry of British Columbia into Confederation in 1871. Many centennial projects emphasized the theme of 100 years of peace and progress, and they highlighted historical events deemed important to this master narrative of state formation and achievement. While provincial events often celebrated popular regional history, local stories were understood in relation to the larger provincial history, just as, on the national stage, provincial history was linked to a larger nationalist discourse. At the heart of the centennials was the imagining of British Columbia as a singular place with a unified past. Regardless of their lasting impact on the public psyche, the centennials left the province with a trail of commemorative plaques, neighborhood improvement projects, libraries, community centers, and totem poles. Early on, centennial organizers wanted to include Aboriginal peoples and their traditions because, for many Canadians, Indigenous culture signified national antiquity and heritage. The modern and progressive state claimed its historic roots in an Aboriginal past. Often, programming incorporated Aboriginal peoples in ways that emphasized a violent pre-contact past, followed by a century of harmonious relations between First Nations and newcomers. Yet at the same time, federal and provincial bureaucrats began to give more room to Aboriginal peoples to direct and control publicly funded representations of their own history and culture. For example, British Columbia established the Indian Participation Committee, including prominent Aboriginal individuals in the planning phase of the province's centennial celebrations. Similarly, the federal government organized an Indian Advisory Council to develop the storyline and content for the Expo 67's Indians of Canada Pavilion. Although these developments seem to indicate increased state consultation with Aboriginal peoples in this pre-white paper era, government bureaucrats did maintain close scrutiny over projects, and at least on the provincial level, a major goal was simply to ensure that Aboriginal peoples would participate in the celebrations, thus ensuring increased tourist dollars. As L.H. McCants, secretary for the Centennial Committee, explained, "We are most anxious to have the Indian people of the province participate in the celebrations, so that they may express their art and culture to the rest of the population of British Columbia, as well as the many guests and tourists who will be with us on this occasion." It was within this context that the province's Committee on Promotions, Displays, and Pageants opened its doors for proposals, many of which emphasized the centrality of Aboriginal history and culture to the province's beginnings. Mildred Valley Thornton, artist and popular lecturer on Northwest Coast cultures, reminded the committee that we should not forget that there is much native talent in other places along the coast. Colorful Indian dances and full ceremonial costumes should definitely be planned for. Marjorie Talbot, who is also interested in Aboriginal folklore, proposed a historical pageant in which the people from the reserves in North Vancouver would act out the Coast Salish legend of the flood, courting and marriage customs, and rituals relating to infant death. She also envisioned a scene featuring Aboriginal people from Harrison Lake talking and dancing around their campfire. She stressed that, because of the elders' impressive oratory skills, there would be little need for extensive rehearsals. For many submissions, interactions with Aboriginal people on the centennial stage were limited by the paradigm of an Aboriginal authenticity located in a historic, unchanging past. Although many proposals came from non-Aboriginal individuals, who were often white, middle-class women engaged in reproducing the idea of a folkloric Indigenous present, Aboriginal people did intervene in the planning discussions. So Hanny Vulture of Vancouver strongly opposed the Centennial Committee's tendency to promote non-Aboriginal interests. "On your board of people about the centennial, who is representing Indian people? Persons of Indian blood or some silly emotional white-skinned biddy?" Employing sexist and ageist language, he continued, "I find it sort of crazy that government people call on some mixed-up old ladies when it comes to our wants instead of calling on us Indians who know what we want." The portrayal of Aboriginal tradition as restricted to the artistic and historic realm faced a gentler critique in more public discourses. An episode of the CBC dramatic series, Caribou Country, featured well-known actor Chief Dan George as Chilcotin elder Ol Antoine. Antoine was meant to represent all Canadian Indians and sing an ancient tribal song for a live national broadcast marking Dominion Day. Yet his reluctant, ambivalent performance poked fun at the absurdity of expecting Aboriginal people to embrace roles rooted in Canadian society's stereotypical Indian, as well as the ease with which Aboriginal people could accommodate such expectations. While some challenged the organizational process of the centennial celebrations and criticized the limited nature of Aboriginal consultation, during this period, many Aboriginal people viewed the centennial program as an opportunity to organize their own public presentations. In 1958, William Scow, president of the Native Brotherhood of British Columbia, suggested that the committee take on the history of the province as portrayed through the eyes of Aboriginal people themselves. Scow's proposed historical pageant included the reconstruction of a traditional longhouse to show how the natives lived and were happy prior to contact, a reenactment of one of the early meetings with the colonial government, and an emphasis on how some Aboriginal people had made progress while others were unable to recover some of their historical pride after the peaceful penetration. Scow argued, quote, "This centennial year can mean a lot to the native people and to the citizens. This is a great opportunity to portray to the public what the native people are, the Aboriginal natives of this great province of ours. I don't mean just on the tail end of a parade with a few feathers where the Americans and foreign visitors to the centennial ceremony will point out and say interesting Indians. After all, 100 years of association with white men and the former governments? Victoria has some vacant lands where it could be portrayed." End quote. In his appeal to the centennial organizers, Scow characterized British imperial expansion, colonial settlement, and state assimilationist policies as quote-unquote peaceful, and he presented a nostalgic and conflict-free representation of pre-contact times. While provincial bureaucrats concurred that Aboriginal peoples have a place in the development of our province, Scow emphasized their relevance to the present and future of British Columbia, a claim that challenged containing authentic Aboriginal life within an unchanging past and or a folkloric present. Like Scow's proposal, submissions from many Aboriginal communities played to the centennial theme, a century of peace and progress. The Nanaimo Indian Band proposed to host a Kol Tai Day Festival of Peace, commemorating a century of peaceful living between our West Coast tribes and also between Indian and non-Indian. Their proposal notes that in the earlier years of our civilization, our Indian brothers came to raid and make war. They still come in their canoes, but today we race each other in friendly rivalry. Similarly, the Root of the Totems dedication ceremony at Tsawwassen, with its emphasis on the antiquity of intertribal warfare, pointed to a more recent post-contact peace between Aboriginal groups. While First Nations self-presentations drew upon the mainstream conventions that European settlement brought tribal peace, and although they emphasized harmonious relations between Aboriginal communities and settler society, they should not be read narrowly as an absolute concession to that view. And although non-Aboriginal audiences, who are steeped in a tradition that distinguishes between Aboriginal or folk cultural tradition and political activity, likely viewed Aboriginal performance as non-confrontational, even nostalgic, these displays contain elements of promotion and protest that were only possible within such celebratory intercultural settings. To highlight their contemporary presence, Aboriginal peoples could recast dominant interpretations of the past in light of their own historical traditions. Non-Aboriginal spectators may not have considered such performances to be directly about land, but for Aboriginal peoples in British Columbia, it was difficult to sidestep references to territorial dispossession when discussing colonial history within any context, especially during the commemoration of the establishment of British Columbia as a formal British colony. In the 1960s, there was a renewed effort on the part of Aboriginal peoples throughout British Columbia to have both federal and provincial governments address the land dispute. As political scientist Paul Tennant has shown, During this period, Aboriginal groups became increasingly organized along tribal lines and more vocal in their pursuit of a resolution to the land dispute. In 1966, the Musqueam joined the newly formed Confederation of Native Indians of British Columbia, CNIBC, a largely Salish-based organization established to coordinate land claims across the province. Shortly thereafter, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh formed the Alliance of British Columbia Indian Bands, known as the Salish Tribal Alliance, to promote land claims and economic development in their communities. Also in 1966, the Musqueam Band Council considered the Musqueam land question and discussed a separate and distinct Aboriginal title claim. Clearly, as struggles for recognition of Aboriginal rights and title gained force during this period, the notion that Aboriginal culture should be relegated to the artistic or historical realm was seriously challenged. Frank Calder, president of the Nisga Tribal Council, pointed to the wide gap between the government's categorization of Aboriginal cultural unity and Aboriginal political activity. In writing to the National Centennial Commission, he questioned the granting of funds to the CNIBC, arguing that the non-treaty Indians in this province, through their respective officially recognized organizations, advocate unity based upon their own initiative and finances, for the express purpose of settling their unsurrendered Indian lands, and they cannot perceive why they should accept government grants for unity when they may have to confront the government in court over the BC Indian land claims issue. Calder revealed that the government's distinction between Aboriginal culture and politics had little meaning for the Nisga, who are preparing for a court battle over their own territory in the Naas Valley. It made little sense that the state offered financial support for the promotion of culture, but did not recognize the importance of that culture in establishing and defining Aboriginal ownership of territory. For the Nisga, oral tradition, the songs, crests, and names owned by families, expressed the histories of their ownership of specific territories. Provincial bureaucrats also failed to acknowledge that commemorative projects were part of an Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal dialogue about land claims and cultural political autonomy. As George Sweeney, the provincial representative who organized celebrations surrounding the 1978 bicentenary of Captain Cook's voyage to the Northwest Coast, indicated in his response to demands made by the West Coast District Council of Chiefs, in exchange for their participation in a historical reenactment. Quote, "I can't argue all the old arguments with them. They're asking us for the impossible, things that should be discussed with the government, not a bicentennial committee that is trying to organize festivities to commemorate a historic event." End quote. The provincial government viewed history, or culture, and politics, or land claims, as distinct and separate areas of involvement. In the end, the committee approved funding for some projects organized by local Aboriginal groups, canoe races, powwows, and Indian Day celebrations. For many Aboriginal peoples, showing non-Aboriginals their art and culture in order to facilitate greater appreciation and understanding was important, but they also thought that commemorative events should be more than a show for tourists. As the Sioux of Fort Capel reported to Canada's Centennial Committee, potentially these events could be used to encourage our own people to retain the beliefs, customs, and legends which have been an essential part of our heritage. Performing for non-Aboriginal others strengthen one's own cultural traditions and sharpen local Aboriginal identity. And certainly in the hands of prominent Aboriginal politicians, such as William Scow and Frank Calder, participation in the centennial celebrations could be a form of social action that conveyed politicized messages about cultural and economic vitality, colonial history, and Aboriginal identity. Aboriginal peoples did not leave dominant histories uncontested. Rather, centennial events were a potential, though limited, site of public debate about history. As historian David Cohen confirms, commemorations are socially constructed events in which struggles for the control of knowledge may break out into the open, yet may also be regulated and contained. The Indian Participation Committee resolved that the major project for the 1966 centennial would be the installation of totem poles at scenic locations on the Vancouver Island Highway and at the ferry terminals. Anthropologist Wilson Duff, who acted in a supervisory role for the project, decided that the poles should be uniform 12 feet high and that the grizzly bear should be the prominent character. The remainder of the design was left to each artist, although Duff encouraged the artist to depict a legend from the local area in which the pole was to be erected and to carve in their own tribal style. Duff wanted the poles to represent the post-contact trading routes of the Haida from the Queen Charlotte Islands to Victoria. Because the ferry terminals at Skidigate and Victoria marked the beginning and the end of these Haida journeys, the ferries, decorated with Haida carvings, could be interpreted as modern-day equivalents of the traditional Haida canoe, thus imposing Aboriginal origins on the modern transportation system. Similarly, David Price, the Tsawwassen ferry terminal manager, compared the present-day friendly canoes traveling hourly to and from Vancouver Island to those that plied the same waters hundreds of years ago. However, during the planning phase of the project, Duff noted that the modern Haida route, Victoria, Port Hardy, Prince Rupert, does not touch Haida territory. It passes through Coast Salish, Kwakiutl, and Tsimshian territories. Each of these distinct peoples has a history of strife with the Haida and possesses an art style of its own, so that it would not be appropriate to have the markers of Haida style in their territories. Despite Wilson Duff's concern over reproducing the distinctive artistic styles of separate Aboriginal nations, he struggled to find an appropriate Salish carver for the poles to be placed at the sites within Coast Salish territory, those to be placed between Qualicum and Victoria, and the pole to be placed at Tsawwassen. In reference to Salish carving, he reported, "In the past, this was not an area where the totem carver's art was highly developed, and there are few carvers now whose work is of the required quality. Perhaps the most promising is Simon Charlie of Duncan. Jimmy Johns of Nanaimo, actually a Nootka, is also a good carver who has been selling his work for many years. An alternative would be Henry Hunt to produce carvings, copying the Salish style." In the end, Sam Henderson created the pole for Tsawwassen, and as Duff reported, he carved in an authentic modern Kwakiutl style, suggesting little reference to Coast Salish artistic traditions. Furthermore, despite Duff's regard for geographical and national specificity, the Musqueam and other central Coast Salish peoples did not have a long-standing tradition of totem pole carving. While the northern northwest coast peoples carved totem poles to depict family or clan history, associated stories, crests, and other prerogatives, Coast Salish artists carved house posts to depict ancestors and animal or spirit powers associated with family history. House posts were either part of the structural traditional cedar plank longhouses, or they were decorative boards within their interiors. Although Salish people have carved totem poles in a northern style for sale or installation throughout Coast Salish country, by the 1960s, the number of such poles appearing in highly visible civic sites throughout the Lower Mainland became a concern to Coast Salish peoples, who were experiencing a revitalization of their traditional arts and culture. As Dominic Point joked in relation to the Tsawwassen pole raising, it would be a shame for another white man to start up the wars again by misplacing his totem poles. By the 1960s, the totem pole had long been a popular symbol of British Columbia. Vancouver's Totem Land Society promoted the slogan, "Totem Land, a great place to live, work, and play." It also promoted the design based on the Thunderbird totem as the insignia of the province. Furthermore, the totem pole has had a lengthy history as a marker of Canadian heritage. "Every city and town in Canada should have one," proposed Thomas Deasy, the Indian agent for the Queen Charlotte Islands in 1916. The totem pole came to signify a region and was generally considered to be the product of an imagined Northwest Coast Indian, rather than the tradition of a specific group or the creative product of an individual artist. Art historian Aldona Jonaitis explains, "The subtleties among the Tlingit, Haida, Tsimshian, Salish, Nootka, Nuth, and Kwakiutl are lost in the homogenization of cultures, in which totem poles become representations of an area rather than artworks made by specific peoples." While Jonaitis and other commentators rightly pointed out that such oversimplification functions to disembody tradition and to contain or to domesticate culture, few historians have examined the ways in which Aboriginal people themselves were implicated in reproducing this discourse of homogenization. In 1958, the province commissioned Kwok Wok Yawakwa master carvers Mungo Martin and Henry Hunt to create a monumental totem pole to be presented to Queen Elizabeth on the occasion of British Columbia's centenary. At the pole departure ceremony in Victoria, Mungo Martin began his speech as follows, quote, "Today I'm a proud chief. This totem pole was a great challenge to me, and for a while I doubted I could carry it through. Now today here lies my work. Never before has there been such a totem pole as this. It represents the native Indians of British Columbia. It represents British Columbia itself. Here is a story that will never be forgotten. The Centennial Committee has done well to commemorate the history of the last century. We, the people of British Columbia, have good reason to be proud. Let us join together, Indians and white people together, to celebrate the centennial year." End quote. Here, Martin accommodated the popular convention linking totem poles with British Columbia's identity. He went on to explain that the figures on the pole represented the 10 tribes of my people. The centennial pole incorporated Tsimshian, Haida, and Kwakiutl figures, as well as the Thunderbird. Martin made no specific reference to the Salish groups of the South and ignored many other Aboriginal groups, for example, several Athapascan nations, the Tlingit, and the Nuu-Chah-Nuth. What he did was to identify certain northern tribes, thus emphasizing the northern coastal traditions with which his audience would have been most familiar. In the 1950s and 60s, non-Aboriginal audiences had limited familiarity with the great diversity of Aboriginal cultures in British Columbia, even though this period witnessed an increased emphasis on local histories and an increased academic interest in the Coast Salish. The homogenization of Northwest Coast culture was an evolutionary formulation that promoted and privileged northern coastal forms over Salish ones, and that contributed to the diminution of Salish visibility well into the 20th century. It was derived from anthropological theorizing about the movement of cultural change from the simple to the complex, or in the case of art, from the south to the north. As Wilson Duff commented, "One of my assumptions is that some of the roots of Northwest Coast art are in the south." Yet Aboriginal peoples also reproduced this discourse of northern superiority, a theme that would obviously appeal to more northern Aboriginals than to people from the south. In 1957, Haida artist Bill Reid offered his creative services to the BC Centennial Committee, noting, "I believe I can be of some service in assuring a high standard of native designs used during the centennial, as the arts of the coast, particularly of the North Coast, where the culture was the richest, has been a lifelong study of mine, and in fact, I'm one of the last practitioners of that art." Within this historical context, it is not surprising that the province adopted the totem pole as its main symbol for the 1966 centennial. For the organizers, the root of the totems was a reasonable endeavor that would both encourage non-Aboriginal appreciation of the province's Aboriginal heritage and would help the local Indians to revive and perpetuate their native customs. Wilson Duff and the Indian Participation Committee had worked hard to commission talented carvers to produce first-class poles, and they tried to pay attention to local sensibilities. Duff and Nuu-Chah-Nuth artist George Clutesi judged the final submissions, either approving their inclusion in the project and final payment to the artist, or recommending alterations if the poles did not meet their standards. But were these poles the appropriate vehicle for displaying the culture of all involved? The press warned that Chief Dominic Point of the Musqueam Indians will lead a war party to Tsawwassen on Saturday to protest the extension of the Haida route into his territory. The Musqueams, traditional enemies of the Haida, will express their disapproval with a war dance. While Musqueam participated within the framework of the pole's dedication ceremony, their media performance challenged the popular meanings produced by the event. Band manager Willard Sparrow told the press that, "If the government is going to use totems, it should use full-size ones, not the 12-foot poles marking the Haida route." Sparrow went on to claim that the historians greatly overrated the prowess of the Haida as warriors. "You just have to take a look at the stooped and hunched figures on their carvings to see that there was nothing to fear from them." For Sparrow, this particular Haida pole, as it came to be known, was not real. It was too short. By conflating carving styles with fighting capabilities, Sparrow toyed with what he believed were misguided criteria for determining authenticity. He played with the assumption that a totem pole could stand for both an imagined British Columbia and local Aboriginal identities at the same time. His use of irony, however, suggests that he was not rejecting cultural production for tourism per se. Clearly, the Musqueam themselves were capitalizing on the touristic gaze with their publicity stunt. Yet his critique pointed to the project's failure to publicly distinguish the boundaries between culture as practiced and understood within the Coast Salish community and culture as produced specifically for commercial purposes. Participating in the dedication ceremony was a way to invert the non-Aboriginal privileging of northern coastal narratives in order to obtain Musqueam publicity. In this way, Musqueam involvement moved from participation to protest. As noted, this protest was not really about debating the merits of totem pole carving. The Musqueam were reacting to the accuracy of the history that was being told by the placement of a totem pole at Tawasin, a history that implied that the Haida had made successful pre-contact raiding excursions at that particular site. Never in our long history of wars with the Haida and the occultists did one of them get through to Tawasin, Willard Sparrow proclaimed to the press. The extension of the route of the Haidas to Tawasin has no foundation in history. And while there is little documentary evidence that the Haida raided villages on the Fraser River in the 1800s or before, the Lekwiltuk, or Ucutlis people, a division of the Kwakwala-speaking people living at Queen Charlotte Strait and, by the 1840s, at Cape Mudge and Campbell River, are known to have raided along the lower Fraser in the early 19th century. Sparrow countered the Haida-centered narrative with a story of a retaliatory raid, stressing that the Musqueam were brave warriors and strong men. Quote, "One of the great wars between the Musqueam and the Indians from the north coast was touched off when the occultists attacked a longhouse near Chimanis and killed all the occupants. This was during the time of our great warrior, Kayaplanok, Capilano, a name borrowed by the Squamish Indians of North Vancouver and never returned. And an attack like this had to be answered with total war. Within a few days, Nanus Bay, north of Nanaimo, literally overflowed with war canoes, and preparations began for the great attack. The occultists were found potlatching at Cape Mudge, on Quadra Island off Campbell River, and the attack was launched just after midnight. Not one of them escaped. I can't remember whether it was 13 or 25 war canoes we filled with their heads." End quote. Such thrilling local dramas of pre-contact raiding and violence added the spectacle of cultural difference to the unveiling ceremony. It is likely, however, that Coast Salish peoples understood the reference to warriors quite differently from their non-Aboriginal counterparts. In traditional times, there was a well-defined category of people, the members of which were specially trained as Stumtamuk. Generally, considered antisocial and aggressive, Stumtamuk operated outside the realm of acceptable behavior and normal authority systems. They weren't doing something that was sanctioned by Musqueam people. They did what they wanted to do, Elder Dominic Point explained in 1996 in a personal communication. While many people, both men and women, protected Musqueam villages from Lekwiltuk raiders or entered into retaliatory excursions into other territories, Stumtamuk had extraordinary fighting capabilities that were derived from their connection to sources of spirit power. And while the members of the 1960s dance troupe were certainly not Stumtamuk in a traditional spiritual sense, their dance evoked the power of the warrior and of a time past. It spoke of tradition. For non-Aboriginal spectators, the dance was meant to be a forceful visual reminder that Musqueam have retained knowledge about the past, connections to spirit power, and unbroken ties to their ancestors. Furthermore, because the Musqueam's warrior dance described stories that referred to specific sites, the places where wars took place, where Lekwiltuk raiders were repelled, and so forth, the performance linked the dancers to a particular territory, that is, it reinscribed an indigenous presence on the site, something that was important in the increasingly politicized days of the 1960s. In their performance, the Musqueam were asserting their independence and distinctiveness without breaching solidarity with other Aboriginal communities. Numerous commentators have considered secular festivals, such as summer powwows and canoe races, as public stages for the exhibition of pride in being Aboriginal. Yet this centennial performance suggests that Aboriginal peoples also projected public identities more in line with local Indian band affiliations. At the centennial show, the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsawwassen representatives distinguished between themselves as separate Aboriginal communities, and with their unique performances, they signaled a common Salish heritage that stood in contrast to that of northern coastal peoples. But the articulation of one's identity as Musqueam, Squamish, or Tsawwassen did not discount the possibility of expressing, on one hand, a pan-Indian alliance, and on the other, affiliations with particular families. Clearly, Aboriginal identity does not fit snugly into anthropological or legal categories, as Aboriginal peoples have kin ties across the classificatory and membership boundaries of Indian bands. Marking one's identity as simultaneously Musqueam and Indian was especially important in the late 1960s, when Aboriginal groups were attempting to create a unified political front to address Aboriginal rights and title. As art historian Tom Hill notes, somehow, during this period of consciousness, energy, and determination, Native Americans and First Nations in Canada found a way to move towards seemingly contradictory objectives. They developed a pan-Indian identity that emphasized intertribal unity, and at the same time, they reaffirmed traditions unique to their own tribes and nations. Public performances, such as the 1966 centennial event, dramatized both the historically based nationhood and contemporary political unity. By signaling the lengthy history of various distinct First Nations, the performances helped to build and reinforce those very entities. For the Musqueam dancers, involvement in the centennial was more than an amusing Saturday afternoon. It was a way to redefine the site as Coast Salish, to reinstate local territorial and cultural identities that had been dispossessed through the colonial processes of reserve creation, land alienation, and the discursive formulation of northern coastal cultures as representative of British Columbia. It did not matter that the pole had been carved by a skilled Aboriginal artist or that Aboriginal people participated in the planning of the project. By 1966, tonal poles could not be erected in Coast Salish country as a symbol of the province without local intervention. But at the same time, the Musqueam did not challenge the celebratory atmosphere of the Tsawwassen event. They did not demand that the pole be removed, and although Sparrow told the press that he would make a formal complaint to the provincial government, the dance was described as mock disapproval. "We're all one people now. The dance was just to add a little ceremony," reassured Sparrow. To complete the narrative, Chief Point broke his wooden spear and placed it at the base of the pole, thus signifying that the tribal wars were part of the past. Deciding how to make themselves visible in a way that was culturally appropriate was an ongoing challenge for the Musqueam community. Not everything within the culture was up for grabs. Because much of Coast Salish cultural expression occurred in private or ceremonial contexts not considered appropriate for display to outsiders, the staging of a public performance was the result of careful intra-community negotiation about protocol. Such debates, though largely invisible to outsiders, myself as an academic researcher included, reveal that strategies of resistance are shaped by culture. The Musqueam made distinctions between what aspects of their culture could be displayed to outsiders and what aspects could not. Musqueam political expression, then, was bounded by cultural protocol. A protocol, of course, that could be flexible and responsive to the changing needs of the community. Quote, "Because an Indian must be a warrior before he can ascribe to becoming a chief, the first part of the ritual was to initiate the reeve into the Brotherhood of Warriors. This was accomplished by a warrior dance performed by the Musqueam band and the placing of a headband on the reeve's head. He was also given a spear denoting that now a warrior, he would be expected to go hunting. Other symbolic dances performed were the giving of the name dance and the squee-squee or mask dance. This later expressed the acceptance of the new leader by the rest of the band, and the performing of the dance on Saturday night was only the second time it had ever been done for white people. Ricky Jacobs, direct descendant of the ancient Tsawwassen chief Kimmit, removed the one feather headband and placed the larger chief's headdress on the reeve's head. This headdress is made up of eagle feathers, eider, and duck feathers. The 28 eagle feathers are symbolic of outstanding deeds accomplished by the warrior before he becomes a chief." End quote. A reporter from Delta's community newspaper described the events surrounding the evening portion of the centennial program. The granting of an honorary Tsawwassen chieftainship to Mayor Taylor and an elaborate naming ceremony at the town's shopping mall. The large crowd were told that they would witness a rare performance of the mask dance, which had been performed only once before for white people. The non-Aboriginal spectators were to be included in an ancient naming ritual, identical to those performed years ago. Yet what they saw was a carefully staged display that was very different from a naming ceremony, as it would have been conducted within the Musqueam community in the late 1960s or before. For example, a naming ceremony includes the payment of witnesses, a public recounting of the genealogy of the particular name to be given, and sometimes the performance of hereditary privileges, such as the mask dance. The mayor's naming ceremony drew from both Coast Salish traditions and other invented or imported elements, such as the placing of a feather headdress on the mayor's head. Together, the Tsawwassen and Musqueam participants named Taylor a chief, knowing that the title of chief was a colonial invention introduced by the arrival of the white man. People did not receive chieftainships in formal ceremonies. Rather, respected individuals became important family leaders because of their behavior, knowledge, prestige, and status. Furthermore, while a person was meant to distinguish him or herself prior to receiving an ancestral name, there's no prerequisite about being a warrior or performing outstanding deeds. Rather, a person's name was an important marker of family heritage. Howard E. Grant compares the naming ceremony to a historical journal used to corroborate the bloodline of the individual receiving an ancestral name. When you went to a ceremony, it was to present factual evidence to support why the individual would be given a name, validating your privilege to carry a name. The Coast Salish naming ceremony was, and remains, an important institution for asserting and verifying genealogical history. Most important, it was and is a public affirmation of family connections, authority, and privilege, connections that the Delta mayor, being without Coast Salish genealogy, would obviously not possess. Why would the Musqueam and Tsawwassen orchestrate a naming ceremony for a white politician? By the 1960s, the presenting of Aboriginal names or titles to dignitaries, government officials, or sympathetic whites was a well-established practice in Canada. For example, in 1938, during an elaborate ceremony on the shores of Harrison Lake, representatives of the Chehalis Band gave A. Wells Gray, the Provincial Minister of Lands, an honorary chieftainship in recognition of his role as preserver of the forests. Similarly, in 1946, at the Diamond Jubilee celebrations in Vancouver, Native Brotherhood President William Scow bestowed upon Viscount Alexander, the Governor General of Canada, a full chieftainship of British Columbia's Indians, and gave him the distinguished Kwakiutl name, Chief Nakapunkim. By declaring Taylor both a warrior and a chief, the Musqueam and Tsawwassen played with white expectations of tradition. Perhaps making white dignitaries Indian was a way to symbolically incorporate non-Aboriginals into the Aboriginal community, transforming white politicians into pseudo-kin or inter-villagers with certain obligations and responsibilities. During this period, as before, government bureaucrats and Aboriginal politicians did not always see eye to eye with regard to Aboriginal struggles for self-determination. For example, in 1966, on the Vancouver civic scene, the Musqueam challenged the city's right to tax leased property on their reserve. However, on the cultural stage, such ceremonies could be viewed as symbolic acts of inclusion or as acts of public relation for both the Aboriginal participants and the state. They were diplomatic gestures. Cultural performance facilitated positive relations with state representatives in a way that the non-Aboriginal community could perceive as authentic or traditional, but that did not challenge protocol as was practiced within the Aboriginal community. But what is especially striking about this particular show was that during Taylor's naming ceremony, Musqueam dancers performed the Skwe Kwe mask dance. In Coast Salish tradition, much cultural and historical knowledge is of a private nature. It is related to one's personal relationship to the ritual world and is therefore not disclosed or talked about. Similarly, not all performance traditions or dance paraphernalia are suitable for display to outsiders. The Skwekwe is not owned by all Coast Salish people, but is a family prerogative performed as a cleansing device to wash persons undergoing life crises, changes in status, or removal of some source of shame. Skwekwe performance requires an audience because it is important in reaffirming and maintaining one's social status within the community. But in the 1960s, the necessity of performing before an audience did not mean that the Skwekwe dance could be performed before a centennial event crowd. Clearly, today Musqueam families generally consider this particular mass dance to be appropriate for display or use outside of the ritual context. Explaining the absence of Coast Salish Skwekwe masks in the Vancouver Art Gallery's 1998 exhibit Down from the Shimmering Sky, Masks of the Northwest Coast, Musqueam elder Andrew C. Charles proclaimed to the opening night guests, quote, "From our beginnings, the Skwekwe masks were used for blessing and cleansing persons who are born into the rites of its use. Skwekwe is used for naming, marriage, funerals, memorials, and young girls at the age of puberty. Of course, the change room for donning of the Skwekwe regalia is strictly out of bounds for everyone, except for the performers. For those of us who belong to the Skwekwe, we hold its importance most sacredly and refuse to publicly display it as an art form." End quote. Despite this contemporary restriction on public disclosure, Coast Salish people have, at least since the late 19th century, occasionally performed the dance with a large number of non-Aboriginals in attendance. Yet, with the revival of longhouse practices in the 1950s and 1960s, came increased community criticism, and new restrictions were placed upon what non-Aboriginal audiences could see. Today, at Musqueam, the Skwekwe mask dance is performed almost exclusively within a ceremonial context, for a person's naming ceremony or funeral, and only if that person has a hereditary right to the mask. Its absence from public view, as Charles was well aware, more forcefully makes the point that the Musqueam have something sacred and powerful than would be the case if it were disclosed to the public during events such as an art exhibit. Yet back in 1966 at Tawasin, the Musqueam Skwekwe dancers decided to use the mask dance to show both non-Aboriginal spectators and other Aboriginal participants that they had something strong and powerful. The Musqueam drew upon tradition to reveal themselves to non-Aboriginal others, whom they felt knew little about their distinctive cultural practices. Additionally, it was hoped that such self-presentations would counter the negative images of urban Aboriginal people that were circulating in mainstream society. Images such as the province's depiction of Musqueam spiritual practices, cited at the beginning of this article, as gloomy and eerie. The Skwekwe mask dance, with its stunning costumes and mesmerizing movement, would have offered a striking contrast to more familiar Aboriginal performance traditions. For example, prairie-style powwow dancing. Anthropologist Chryska Bierwert describes the visual spectacle with a sense of wonder. Not only do four or more masked dancers dance simultaneously, but they wear spectacular regalia, a composite of multiple images and textures, including rattles, protruding wands and strands, bright colors. The dancing also creates a soft flurry of down that swirls from the headgear, a gentle visual sign suffusing what is otherwise a clamoring of dramatic sight and sound. Mayor Taylor's naming ceremony was the result of careful selection of cultural elements designed to convey a number of different messages to diverse audiences. Although it is difficult to know exactly how audiences read the message, it is possible that non-Aboriginal spectators viewed it as an authentic and rich display of local Indianness, that other First Nations viewed it as a demonstration of traditional knowledge, power, and hereditary privileges, and that a local politician viewed it as his civic obligation. For the Musqueam, the ceremony was an exercise in nation-building, diplomatic exchange, and publicity. Some academics have argued that the incorporation of Indigenous expressive culture and history into mainstream cultural events has decontextualized and erased cultural meaning. It has become another way of silencing Aboriginal peoples. Art historian Marcia Crosby suggests that the incorporation of indigenous visual imagery into constructions of dominant culture obscures the intricate meanings encoded in ritual, regalia, and other forms of expressive culture. Similarly, Chryska Bierwert proposes that the absence of spiritual meanings in publicly performed dance created a surface representation and left spectators incapable of seeing the depths of religious practice. This may be true, but it is possible that sub-Aboriginal peoples in past times did not consider it important that outsiders understand all of the ritual or cultural significance of their displays. Alternatively, for some communities or families, much of that cultural knowledge has been carefully guarded. How Aboriginal peoples have utilized public events to fashion representations of themselves and their history while keeping other aspects of their culture silent or inaccessible to whites has been little examined within the Canadian context. A strategy of remaining silent or invisible on one front allowed the Musqueam to keep sacred or private cultural practices away from public attention. Exposing aspects of the culture, such as the Musqueam warrior dance, on another front, redirected the white gaze to something secular. As anthropologist Michael Q clearly explains, the secular dancing also acts as a buffer for the sacred, for it fills the expectations of the larger society and allows the sacred dancing to remain inviolate. Thus, the sometimes phony summer dancing is part of the total front of identity, which, like many subordinate groups, the Indians present in order to remain themselves. During British Columbia's 1966 centennial, the Musqueam employed their own cultural traditions while acknowledging the more popular constructions of Aboriginality in order to send several political messages. However, it is important not to amplify this activity as the product of a continuous, diligent political strategy. Over the years, Musqueam dancers most certainly approached requests for performances with discrimination and hesitancy. A 1978 community notice outlined a number of issues regarding participation in the bicentenary celebrations of Captain Cook's voyage to the Northwest Coast, asking, "What is your opinion? How do you feel about such an event? Is it possible to take advantage of such an event for the benefit of our people, for recognition of our rights and customs? Or do you feel that participation would have the effect of repeating history?" Evidently, community members were faced with the dilemma of representing historical events within a colonialist framework or using such events for their own publicity purposes. Performers have long recognized, as did Crosby and Bierwert, the limitations of cultural expression, questioning whether putting their culture on show is worth the trouble because white audiences did not always get it. According to Howard E. Grant, in post-performance discussions at Musqueam, the Centennial's audience's failure to understand the profound cultural significance of the Skwe Kwe was one of the reasons why the dance was withdrawn from the public realm, and partially accounts for the persistence of the warrior dancers as Musqueam's principal performance troupe today. This persistence, however, leaves contemporary performers open to community criticism regarding the authenticity of their shows. As one individual commented when asked about the warrior dance's origins, "I didn't even know about it until recently. It's not real Musqueam dance, just what we do in the malls for newcomers." The appropriate public presentation of Aboriginal culture, which was so closely connected to family ownership, personal expression, and community protocol, was often tricky business for many Coast Salish communities. The community restrictions that said that dances such as the spirit dance or the Skwe Kwe should not be performed in non-Coast Salish context, magnify the problem of visibility and contributed to erasing the Coast Salish from the Canadian cultural map. That, along with the unrelenting inundation of Vancouver's landscape with northern art forms, most notably the totem pole, meant that the Musqueam and other local Aboriginal groups became difficult to see. Instead of risking being ignored, however, the Musqueam have responded creatively to this potential erasure by constructing a public identity that pays careful attention to both internal cultural protocol and white expectations of Aboriginality. Today, the Musqueam Warrior Dance Troupe is in great demand, performing, for example, at UBC's Museum of Anthropology, for the opening of rock concerts, at festivals, and during the opening dedication of the newly renovated Vancouver International Airport. At the outset of the 21st century, it seems that the Musqueam's message of historical continuity has entered the mainstream. Perhaps Musqueam's presentation of history and culture over the past century have helped many people to understand that Canadian society has somehow assumed control over much of Musqueam territory. However, it is less certain how successful these same performances have been at linking the colonial acquisition of land with contemporary legal claims for Aboriginal rights and title. As Julie Cruikshank points out in relation to a perceived intrusion of politics at Yukon Storytelling Festival in the mid-1990s, if narrators use explicitly non-Indigenous forms to address political issues, they risk censure. If they use more implicit forms, they may be heard only by those who share local cultural knowledge. Because these performances do not directly engage in politics, people may not recognize them as political statements. During the 1989 protest over the transfer of the university endowment lands from provincial jurisdiction to the Greater Vancouver Regional District, a newspaper photograph depicts the warrior dancers performing alongside Musqueam band members holding placards reading "Musqueam title is alive and well in UEL" and "No apartheid in Canada." There would have been little misunderstanding regarding the politicized meanings of the warrior dance at this event. This photograph highlights the flexibility of cultural display. A dance can be employed to protest in the most forthright manner, but can also be used to protest in a way that does not challenge mainstream expectations with regard to displays of Aboriginal culture and history. The struggle for the recognition of Aboriginal rights and title has been waged on several fronts and has included both formal political activities and cultural presentations. I've examined the latter type of struggle, but I've tried to keep in mind its close relationship to the first type, arguing, following Cruikshank, Miller, and Myers, for a closer examination of the long-standing Western dichotomy between Aboriginal culture and Aboriginal politics. It is obvious that petition writing, for example, is a kind of political activity designed to resolve perceived injustices. Yet if we understand politics to encompass the strategies employed by Aboriginal communities to further their existence, visibility, and recognition as nations, then other activities, such as the display of expressive culture, can also be understood as political strategies, not simply as texts or representations standing outside the real activity of participants. Politics, protest, and publicity appear to be at the heart of many performances of culture, and new forms of diplomacy, whether a totem pole raising, a canoe race, or a naming ceremony for a white politician, are formed at the intersection of Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal understandings of the authentic. I do not argue that cultural protest has toppled colonialism. Rather, I argue that some cultural presentations appear to draw from the concepts and symbols that support colonialism. Yes, non-Aboriginal spectators may have simply seen in the Musqueam's dance a story that highlighted past strife and present unity, a narrative that fits the centennial's theme of 100 years of peace and progress. But publics are not always so incapable of seeing complex and diverse messages, and Aboriginal performers take their audiences extremely seriously as witnesses. Some audience members may have noted cultural richness, power, and the meaningful connections between history, people, and place. For the Musqueam, however, self-presentations of culture and history have been important in their effort to remain visible in the major urban metropolis of Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Cultural performance makes the connection between people and place visible, tangible, and it is hoped memorable. In performing a dance during the 1966 British Columbia Centennial, Musqueam people presented a nationalistic image of their community that is deeply rooted in the past, yet very much situated in contemporary political and cultural life, an image that is in accord with the ongoing battle for political and cultural autonomy.